Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Coming up, we'll hear from Nick Jansen and Stephen Lattimore on the latest from East Chicago as newly appointed Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, visited with government officials in East Chicago this week, as well as Sharon Jackson's story on what can be done to legally ward off Canada geese off your property. And regionally speaking host Chris Nolte talks with Bill Hicks about job outlooks for Hoosiers. We'd like to congratulate Stephen Lattimore for his winning of the Indiana Associated Press's Best Reporter of the Year, as well for his Best Enterprise story. For more information on the AP awards that Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, won last weekend, visit lakeshorepublicradio.org. Previous Lakeshore Update podcasts can be found online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Just click on the programs link for Lakeshore Update. Podcasts can also be heard on NPR One. Search for WLPR and make us your home station. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt made his first visit to a Superfund site Wednesday, meeting in East Chicago with residents affected by lead contamination and their elected leaders. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports, Pruitt's tour came during heightened calls for environmental justice in East Chicago from the NAACP.
Pruitt made a short statement outside the shuttered Kerry Gosch Elementary School in East Chicago's USS-led Superfund. That came after a closed briefing with Governor Eric Holcomb, state and federal lawmakers, and local officials.
And the reason I'm here is because it's important that we restore confidence for the people here in this community that we're going to get it right going forward.
Pruitt didn't elaborate on the, quote, concrete steps discussed, but EPA officials said later that they're working to speed up excavation of contaminated yards and expand lead testing in East Chicago's drinking water. Earlier in the day, NAACP officials said they'd welcome more testing. NAACP President Cornell Brooks also called for the state to extend its emergency declaration in the area indefinitely and for the creation of a victims' compensation fund to make residents, as he says, whole.
And by whole, we don't mean merely making the land whole. We don't merely mean making the buildings whole. We mean making the people whole.
Brooks says his organization would apply lessons learned in Flint, Michigan to East Chicago, and would pursue any avenues necessary, including lawsuits, to ensure residents receive the assistance they deserve. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen in East Chicago with Annie Ropeek.
For local reaction of Pruitt's visit to East Chicago, here's Indiana AP Reporter of the Year, Stephen Lattimore.
In East Chicago, politicians appear to be happy with the results from the visit by EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, Governor Eric Holcomb.
The collaboration, I think, is working. It means we are here and we are staying and we're not going to leave until we get the job done, and then we'll be here a little longer.
U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly.
This is not one day or one issue. This is about making sure that every child and family in East Chicago knows that when they drink a glass of water, that it's safe, and it will be. That when they play in their backyard, that they don't have to worry about lead contamination. That our school system here, Superintendent McNulty, will know that we'll make this right with our school here, so that a system that's lost over 400 kids already, we hope we'll be in a position not to lose any more.
State Senator Lonnie Randolph represents East Chicago.
And we're hopeful that with the attention that we're getting now and the focus that's being made on all these key officials, I'm very thankful to our governor.
But activists who are fighting to make sure that residents get the help they need are concerned.
And then to say that you want to cut the guidelines of EPA because they're too strict, that's a problem.
That's right.
Because then you're out to help the industries and not the people who voted you in.
Despite the concerns by some residents in East Chicago, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt says they plan to make things right.
And the reason I'm here is because it's important that we restore confidence for the people here in this community that we're going to get it right going forward, that they can have confidence in their water quality, they can have confidence in land remediation and the valuations of properties and the opportunities in the community are restored.
In East Chicago, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Life around Lake Michigan and Burns Harbor is getting back into some sense of normalcy following a chemical spill into Lake Michigan on Tuesday, April 11th. U.S. Steel resumed operations at its Portage plant, and the National Park Service reopened three previously closed beaches at Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore on Monday, April 17th. Indiana American Water says its Ogden Dunes water plant resumed operations Tuesday, April 18th, after tests showed that the contaminated water contained hexavalent chromium levels below the Environmental Protection Agency's detection limit at the utility's intake site on Lake Michigan. The water utility had stopped using Lake Michigan water last week because of the chemical spill. Hexavalent chromium, also known as chromium 6, is a toxic byproduct of industrial processes that the EPA says can lead to serious medical conditions such as cancer. According to the EPA, the National Primary Drinking Water Regulation that established the maximum contaminant level for total chromium of 0.1 milligrams per liter was established in 1991. The chemical made its way into Lake Michigan after an expansion joint failed, allowing wastewater containing the toxic chemical to flow into the wrong treatment plant. That wastewater eventually flowed into Burns Waterway at a point about 100 yards from Lake Michigan. Following the leak, Portage Lakefront and Riverwalk, West Beach, and Cowles Bog, all within the National Lakeshore, were closed last week. Again, all three beaches are now reopened. U.S. Steel says the plant has, quote, encountered no additional issues, unquote, following repairs made last week to the expansion joint, which caused the leak. A prominent grocery chain based in Northwest Indiana announced some big changes this week. Lakeshore Public Radio's Dan Clark reports on how these changes will affect the region as well as Illinois.
Highland-based grocer Strack & Van Til announced Tuesday it will sell off 22 of its stores and close 9 underperforming stores immediately. Strack's parent company, Central Grocers Incorporated, is working with a legal team and financial advisors toward implementing a sale of Strack & Van Til stores, which will continue to operate as normal until a sale is official. Two of the 9 stores closing immediately are based in Indiana, the Gary Ultra and the Merrill Point Ultra in Merrillville. The rest of the 7 stores are based in Illinois. President and CEO of Strack & Van Til, Jeff Strack, said in a statement, "We appreciate the great impact the store closure has on associates, customers, vendors, and the community, and our team is committed to minimizing that impact in every way we can." The company currently operates 32 stores in Illinois and Indiana under the banner names Strack & Van Til, Ultra Foods, and Town & Country Market. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Dan Clark.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update. From Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, I'm Sarah Dykstra. Indiana faces up to an $8.5 billion funding gap for water and wastewater infrastructure over the next 20 years. But some communities are ducking those costs by selling their drinking water systems to private companies. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen takes us to one Northwest Indiana town that's considering just that.
Lake Station, Indiana is treading water.
We have no money whatsoever in this city.
Bill Carroll manages the Ace Hardware in town. I met him last November. Lake Station's operating budget is $2 million overdrawn. Because of the city's debt, the state is forcing budget cuts. Carroll says the city is in danger of not being able to fund the police department. It has bad roads and bad water.
We have no money to fix that. We don't have no money to fix, you know, our dump trucks. We have no money to fix anything. We don't even have enough money to have Christmas decorations, you know, put on down Central Avenue. Well, how are you going to attract people?
Lake Station is considering selling its drinking water utility to a private company, Indiana American Water. The current offer is $20 million. Carroll says that's a huge chunk of money for a town like Lake Station.
And with that, I mean, pay off everything that we owe money to so we can start brand new, fresh and clean.
Given Lake Station's budget problems, a lot of people see selling the water utility as a silver bullet. Indiana American Water would pay for future water infrastructure repairs and upgrades, and the company would assume the $800,000 mortgage the city is paying every year on the new water treatment plant it just built. But there are serious downsides to consider. Lake Station would no longer have control over how much residents pay for water, and that water utility revenue would go to a private company. Because of that, City Councilman Rick Long says he's worried about sustainability, about what happens after the windfall from the utility sale is gone.
When we've spent it on all the needed projects, I wonder what we'll do then. Because we won't have that water income coming in to kind of lean on a little bit to help us out.
And Long says the city would be worse off than it already is without that water revenue, about $2 million a year. Problem is, Lake Station isn't allowed to spend that money on non-water related expenses, like subsidizing other departments that don't bring in as much money. The state already penalized it for doing that, and the city's paying fines for it. But Mayor Chris Anderson says he doesn't have any other choice.
We're faced with two options at this point. We either pay our bills by somewhat paying from funds we're not supposed to be paying from, or we pretty much have shut down the city. I mean, it's not shut down the city, but...
Because of that, Anderson thinks Lake Station should sell its drinking water.
Selling the water will allow us to provide efficient services, and then we'll have a little nest egg there that we've probably never had as a city, to be able to get the most bang for our buck.
The Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission estimates private drinking water companies serve nearly 300,000 Hoosiers. Lake Station City Council has had a few public meetings on the utility sale since December, but it's tabled the question while the city considers a counter to the $20 million offer. And a spokesperson from Indiana American Water says the company still needs to finish a formal engineering study. That will help them figure out whether they need to purchase the city's water tower and that shiny new water filtration plant. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen in Lake Station. This story was produced with Elizabeth Douglas and Inquire First, a nonprofit investigative news service.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. That sweet spot in the year that encompasses the tail end of winter, spring, and even early summer is an important time of the year for Canada geese. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson has more.
Oh, look at there. There they go.
March till June is nesting season for Canada geese, and that can become a problem for Hoosier property owners. During nesting season, these geese are especially aggressive, sometimes attacking and nipping at people to protect their nests. But you can get a permit in Indiana to destroy their eggs and even kill the adults. Megan Dillon, an urban wildlife biologist with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, and I went out to try to find some Canada geese in early April. She educated me on their characteristics and what Hoosiers can do legally to solve overabundance problems.
Their nesting season's like late March, early April?
Usually, it seems like their nesting season gets earlier and earlier every year than the literature would suggest. That could be due to climate change or other reasons, just more favorable habitat, more open water, less ice to deal with. So we've, in some places, already got goslings on the ground. In others, they're just now getting the nest put together.
Canada geese can cause significant damage to landscaping, leaving large amounts of excrement that can render areas unfit for human use, ruining your walk in the park or making your outing at the golf course even more challenging. Hoosiers need to know how to handle these situations because the ideal habitat for Canada geese is right here in Indiana.
The short mowed turf grass around the open water is attractive for a few different reasons. The clear line of sight is one, and it helps them feel safer from incoming predators and allows them to have more time grazing, less time being vigilant for predators. Also, easier passage for young goslings getting in and out of the water. The short grass makes it simple for them to hop on out. And also just the short mowed grass makes for really excellent forage. When the grass is mowed like that, you're actually concentrating the nutrients at the bottom of the shoot, making it really, really efficient food to eat.
I did see the reference nuisance waterfowl. Are they a problem for residents?
You see the term nuisance waterfowl pretty often because they, although are a native species and one that we've worked really hard to conserve, they do have nuisance tendencies just because they can become overabundant. They cause turf damage. It's usually the overabundant fecal matter that's of a big concern to people. And then, of course, the general aggression during the nesting season.
The survival rate for Canada geese is really high in urban areas because of the ideal habitat, with the mowed turf grass that provides them the never-ending salad bar. Also, their typical predators like coyotes or raccoons are often removed or deterred in urban areas. So, if the Canada geese get to be too much, what can you do?
The best way to handle that is actually through landscaping. Just careful consideration of how the landscaping and turf is managed around your pond. Ideally, we won't have turf being mowed right up to the water's edge, and we'll be going with a taller vegetation. Native wildflowers work excellently. It's a good opportunity to install wildflower and pollinator habitat. So that would be the very first solution. Other things you can do include harassment, egg and nest destruction, and just making efforts during that early nesting season to keep them from nesting. Fortunately, Canada geese, they re-nest very readily. So if you are working to deter that nesting and you retrieve the right permit that you need to destroy the eggs and nest and then harass the pair away, you can be pretty confident that they're just going to rebuild a new nest somewhere else and you haven't just ruined that nesting season for that pair.
Can you describe what happens when they get agitated?
Sure. So, I mean, depending on the pair, aggressive geese can come at you in a couple different ways. Usually they just run straight at you. They can hiss, sometimes making a low, grovelly, growling noise. If you actually get the opportunity to handle one, if you're banding or a professional, they will absolutely try to claw you. They seem very aware that they have sharp claws and that they can inflict damage that way and do so readily. And just general kind of flogging behavior we see too, where they're running into people, causing them to trip, using their wings to batter.
I've actually heard that growling noise once. When I was a kid, I tried to walk up to one and I started hearing the rrr.
Yes, I'm not surprised to hear you've been growled at. It doesn't take much to make them mad, and they do very readily defend those nests.
So even though they can hurt you without a permit, you need a permit in many cases before you can take action against them. Canada geese are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, a federal law.
Because of their migratory nature, it's not up to our state alone to manage our geese. That falls to the federal government, so U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Meaning, Migratory Bird Treaty Act protection says that birds cannot be killed, injured, harmed, or harassed on the nest in such a way that prohibits the eggs from hatching. So any form of injury to the bird resulting in death or anything that's going to keep the nest from being successful is going to require a permit.
Some people would probably get upset thinking that you could actually get a permit to...
The three main methods that we talk about with goose damage prevention and management are hunting, harassment, habitat changes. So just about all the techniques fall under that. Egg and nest destruction is, in my opinion, a kind of harassment technique where you do get a permit and you get that online. That's through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And that permit allows you to either addle or destroy the eggs. Those have two different consequences, and it's important to consider what your goal is there. If you've got a really aggressive pair of geese, then addling the eggs won't be your answer. You'll want to destroy the eggs and nest and get the pair to move along, nest somewhere else. If you're having trouble with just nest placement, but the pair in general is not a big pain to you, then egg addling is a great solution. In that case, you're actually coating the eggs with corn oil, or you shake or puncture them. You just render them in such a way that they're not going to hatch, and the geese continue to incubate and are none the wiser. But the cool thing is that you don't end up with a bunch of goslings in a parking lot or some area where it was going to be catastrophic or just not a good nesting site.
Sure. So wait, you're allowed to shake the eggs, puncture them, and make them so they're like inviable.
Uh-huh.
But you're not allowed to hurt the geese. Doesn't that kind of hurt them, though, the eggs?
The distinction is that that's the protection that they carry, which is why you need a permit to do it. So I would argue no, that it's, the eggs don't carry the same protection as the adults, right? Yeah, we don't consider those to be viable birds, if you will. So the egg and nest destruction permits are very simple and easy to get for a private landowner. Just hop online, get it from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's an instant deal. Permits for the take of adult birds, though, including euthanasia and relocation, are more difficult to get and absolutely reserved for worst-case scenarios.
Is there anything else that you wanted to tell me concerning these geese that I haven't asked you?
The most important thing that I want people to know about goose management is not that we're limited to all these various kind of harassment tricks and frightening techniques. The solution's right in front of us. It's the way that we're managing this landscape. You cannot continue to create wonderful goose habitat and expect it to not be occupied by geese.
The Indiana Department of Natural Resources Urban Wildlife Program provides assistance to help establish pond buffers across urban Indiana. For more information, check out the DNR website. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. A gold coin donated to a Northwest Indiana church is so rare, it's helping pay for construction of a new church building. Lakeshore Public Radio's Dan Clark reports.
Pastor Ben Lamb says Grace Point Church was founded in 2009 with a bare-bones budget and operated out of an elementary school. As the church grew, the congregation came together and raised enough money to purchase a building. However, with general maintenance and renovations figured into the cost, the church was still short $300,000. Soon after this revelation, Lamb says a woman who's a member of Grace Point Church in Valparaiso said to him,
"I think I've got a coin that might be able to help."
At first, Lamb says he wasn't aware of how valuable the $20 gold piece coin was until he contacted a few auction houses.
That's when we knew we had something. And so we just did a lot of research. Our team made a lot of phone calls, and man, the rest is history. It's crazy.
Sarah Miller of Heritage Auctions says the $20 gold piece is one of only 10 known surviving 1866 Liberty Head double eagles stamped with "In God We Trust." It could fetch more than $300,000 when it sold at auction April 27th. Pastor Ben Lamb says Heritage Auctions wired the church $150,000 for advance payment toward the coin's final auction price, and that's allowed construction to begin already on the new building. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Dan Clark.
Ball State University Center for Business and Economic Research Executive Director Michael Hicks joined host Chris Nolte on Regionally Speaking on Monday to talk about Indiana and national job outlooks. Here's that conversation.
The job reports nationally over the past 3 months, and we're just first quarter really of 2017, have been pretty strong nationally. Good job creation numbers. More importantly, I think wages are rising and the composition of employment is shifting to more full-time work, strong growth in some sectors that have been dormant for a while, you know, construction, which could be weather-related, but with a high consumer confidence and the housing reports elsewhere suggest the national economy is doing pretty well. And right along with that, the Indiana economy is doing well. Manufacturing employment has risen throughout the year, which has us well above trend. We see overall both employment growth and households moving into the labor market, which is sort of the sign that we're near or at full employment. So workers are shifting into the labor market. They may have been out for various reasons for some time, and that's a sign of strengthening confidence and expectations.
Now, do these reports give any indication to how well Indiana's doing, how we kind of rank among the other states, if not in the Midwest, but the rest of the country, as far as not only jobs, but the wages that those jobs bring?
Right. Well, over the past 5 or 6 years, really since the end of the Great Recession, Indiana has performed about as well as the nation as a whole, which is important because the previous 30 years we had not. We had been, you know, consistently growth in the bottom third of the nation, and so the, you know, almost without exception, each of the years since the end of the Great Recession, Indiana has been right at the national level, and it's important to think about that because, and that's the national average. The states that have done really well tended to be the very big states. Texas has done pretty well. California has done pretty well. Florida has done pretty well. So the average is, the mean is really above the median. So we're doing better than we have for, you know, any of the past 50 years over this 5 or 6 year time period. And I think that really, both in employment and wage growth, had us move from about 42nd to 38th in personal income. So, you know, I would characterize the statewide economy as doing well, although there are places that are doing really, really well and places that are doing poorly.
Mm-hmm. When you take a look at that, you mentioned about how kind of the sections of the state rank as far as the economy is concerned. You mentioned some that do very well and some that don't do as well. In your research there at the center, where do you find these good areas and the areas that need improvement?
Well, I mean, like much of the nation, urban centers are doing well. So Indianapolis is growing at, you know, a stunning pace. Hamilton County for the last two decades has been among the fastest growing counties in the country. You know, top 25 probably out of more than 3,000 counties. But all the donut counties in Indianapolis are doing very well despite, you know, lagging and sort of congestion relief and those sorts of things on their highways. Urban areas outside of Louisville are doing well and are beginning to really grow now that they have a lot more transportation access with the bridge construction. Fort Wayne's done fairly well. It's not a large urban area, but for an urban area its size, it's a standout. And then Porter County has done very well as well. And we care about things like population growth and employment growth and wage growth in those areas. And then really rural places, the counties in between and smaller towns like Terre Haute or Muncie have just really not kept pace and are seeing population decline and employment decline over the past decade and a half.
Now, do we find in communities that are having these problems that the people who are in charge of chambers of commerce and other organizations are doing what they can to try to come up with ways to improve it? And certainly you mentioned about the Muncie area. That's where you are there at Ball State University. The folks around Muncie and Delaware County trying to come up with ways to improve the job picture and more businesses coming in?
I think it's a mixed mixed patch here. Mm-hmm. We characterize two forms of economic development policy, the sort of 20th century policy that was around ubiquitously from, say, 1960s to the 1990s was chasing factories, really trying to lure businesses, new business relocation to an area. And that hasn't really disappeared everywhere yet. I think the most desperate places continue to do that without much success. I mean, a very small percentage of jobs in Indiana are attracted here, something like 1.5% over the past 25 years. But there are a number of communities that are doing what we call 21st century economic development policies, trying to attract people working on their fundamental institutions of schools and local governance, trying to make communities that people would like to move to. I like to hold out Kokomo as an example, but I even think Gary mm-hmm. is a good example, a city that's fairly well led, with a small P progressive mayor who understands that schools matter and clean, safe streets matter and those sorts of things. Other places, I think we still have maybe 30 or 40 counties in Indiana that have local economic developers that are really focused on trying to attract businesses, and that just has not been a successful policy anywhere in Indiana for the past 30 so years.
That was Ball State University Center for Business and Economic Research Executive Director Michael Hicks. Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM Monday through Thursdays from noon to 1 p.m. And podcasts can be heard on lakeshorepublicradio.org. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure to search for WLPR and select us as your home station. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday morning at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with Sharon Jackson on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sarah Dykstra.